A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it picks up a thread we've been circling for a while. He's been thinking about how an altered mental state can let someone reprocess a traumatic or phobic memory in a way that lasts beyond the intoxication itself. He mentions the long human history with hallucinogens, ayahuasca, ibogaine, the psychonaut crowd, but his real question is about the clinical science. What have the most promising trials actually shown? And does this idea of reprocessing under an altered state have a name?
It does have a name. Actually, it has several, and which one you use depends on which mechanism you think is doing the work. The two big contenders are fear extinction and memory reconsolidation, and they are not the same thing.
Walk me through the difference. I've heard you use both terms, and I suspect I'm not the only one who's nodded along without fully grasping the distinction.
Fear extinction is the older model. You take someone with a phobia or a traumatic memory, you expose them to the trigger in a safe environment, and over time, their fear response diminishes. The brain learns a new safety association that competes with the old fear association. But, and this is the crucial part, the original fear memory is still there. It's not erased. It's suppressed. Think of it like putting a sticky note over a sentence in a book. The sentence is still underneath. Under stress, under the right cues, that original fear can come roaring back.
Extinction is fragile.
It's why someone can do exposure therapy for a dog phobia, feel fine for 6 months, and then get bitten again and be right back where they started. The old memory was dormant, not gone. Reconsolidation is different. Every time you retrieve a memory, it becomes temporarily labile, malleable. There's a window of maybe 4 to 6 hours where the memory can be modified before it's restored or reconsolidated back into long-term storage. If you introduce new information during that window, like a safety signal or a reduced emotional charge, you can actually rewrite the memory trace itself, not suppress it.
We're talking about editing the document, not putting a sticky note on it.
That's the metaphor. And here's where the hallucinogens enter the picture. These compounds appear to do two things. First, they make it easier to retrieve emotionally charged memories without being overwhelmed by them. Second, they seem to extend and deepen that reconsolidation window. More plasticity, more opportunity for revision.
Daniel's question about whether there's a described name for this. What would you call it?
The term that's emerging in the literature is memory reconsolidation under pharmacological facilitation. It's a mouthful, and nobody's going to put it on a t-shirt, but it captures what's happening. Some researchers just call it psychedelic-assisted memory reprocessing. The key point is that it's not one mechanism. It's a convergence of reconsolidation research, neuroplasticity research, and the pharmacology of these specific compounds.
All right, let's get into those compounds. What's actually happening in the brain when someone takes psilocybin and sits down with a therapist to confront a traumatic memory?
Psilocybin is primarily a serotonin 2A receptor agonist. When it binds to those 5-HT2A receptors, particularly in the prefrontal cortex, it triggers a cascade that increases neuroplasticity. You get increased dendritic growth. Those are the branches of neurons that receive signals, an increased expression of something called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF. BDNF is basically fertilizer for neurons. It promotes synaptic growth and strengthening.
You're literally growing new connections.
And there's a concept in neuroscience called critical periods. These are developmental windows in childhood when the brain is especially plastic and receptive to learning. Language acquisition is the classic example. After the critical period closes, learning a new language is much harder. What psilocybin appears to do is reopen something like a critical period for social reward learning and emotional processing. A study from Johns Hopkins in 2021 demonstrated this in the context of major depression. They found that psilocybin-assisted therapy produced rapid and sustained reductions in depressive symptoms, and the neuroimaging showed decreased amygdala reactivity and increased connectivity between brain regions that normally don't talk to each other very much.
The amygdala being the brain's fear center.
In PTSD, the amygdala is hyperactive. It's constantly sounding the alarm. What psilocybin seems to do is quiet that alarm while simultaneously increasing crosstalk between the prefrontal cortex, which handles executive function and contextual understanding, and the hippocampus, which handles memory. So the patient can revisit the traumatic memory, but the brain is in a state where it can contextualize it differently. This happened then, I am safe now, and then reconsolidate the memory with that new context baked in.
MDMA works differently.
MDMA is not primarily a classic psychedelic in the 5-HT2A sense. Its main mechanism is massive release of serotonin, but also dopamine and, critically, oxytocin. Oxytocin is the bonding hormone. It's what floods your system when you hold your newborn child or when you're falling in love. It promotes feelings of trust, safety, and social connection.
You're chemically inducing a state of trust.
Yes, and that turns out to be enormously useful for trauma therapy. Trauma, almost by definition, involves a betrayal of safety. The world becomes dangerous. Other people become dangerous. The patient's own memories become dangerous. MDMA reduces activity in the amygdala and increases activity in the prefrontal cortex, so the fear response is dampened. But it also floods the system with oxytocin, which allows the patient to form a particularly strong therapeutic alliance with the therapist and to approach the traumatic memory without being re-traumatized by it.
They can look at the thing that hurt them without being hurt again by the looking.
That's beautifully put. And that's exactly the therapeutic window these compounds create. Now, the clinical data on MDMA for PTSD is genuinely striking. The MAPS organization, now called Lykos Therapeutics, ran two phase 3 trials called MAP1 and MAP2. In those trials, 67% of participants who received MDMA-assisted therapy no longer met the diagnostic criteria for PTSD after just 3 sessions. In the placebo group, it was 32%. That's a massive effect size. These were people with severe chronic PTSD. Many of them had failed multiple other treatments.
Then the FDA rejected it.
In August of 2024, yes. And this is where the story gets complicated, because the rejection was not about efficacy. The FDA did not say this doesn't work. They rejected it because of what's called functional unblinding. In a standard double-blind trial, neither the patient nor the clinician knows who's getting the real drug and who's getting the placebo. That's the gold standard for controlling bias. But MDMA produces very noticeable subjective effects. You feel it. So the participants knew they were on MDMA. Many of them had prior experience with the drug recreationally, and the therapist could tell too. So the concern is that the positive results might be inflated by expectation effects and by the enhanced therapeutic alliance that comes from both parties knowing they're in the active treatment group.
The very thing that makes it work, the subjective experience, also makes it hard to study under the standard model.
That's the paradox, and it's a real methodological challenge. How do you blind a study when the drug announces itself? Some researchers have proposed using active placebos, like niacin, which produces a flushing sensation, or low-dose stimulants, but nothing really mimics the MDMA experience convincingly. The FDA's advisory committee voted overwhelmingly against approval, citing these concerns, and the agency followed their recommendation.
The research hasn't stopped.
Not at all. It's been redirected. Lykos is running additional trials with modified protocols to address the FDA's concerns. Meanwhile, psilocybin has a somewhat cleaner regulatory path because the FDA hasn't issued a comparable rejection, and several institutions are moving forward. NYU and UCSF have phase 2 trials specifically for psilocybin in PTSD, and Imperial College London has been running a fascinating head-to-head trial comparing psilocybin-assisted therapy to escitalopram. That's Lexapro, for treatment-resistant depression.
I saw preliminary results from that one. What did they find?
The 2025 data showed that both treatments produced significant improvement at 6 weeks, but the psilocybin group showed more durable changes in brain connectivity at the 6-month follow-up. The escitalopram group tended to revert toward their pre-treatment connectivity patterns once they stopped the medication. The psilocybin group didn't, which fits the reconsolidation model. You're not just managing symptoms, you're restructuring the underlying neural architecture.
That's the difference between editing the document and putting a sticky note on it again.
And that durability question is the holy grail of psychiatry. Most psychiatric medications require ongoing use. You stop taking your SSRI, and within weeks or months, the old patterns tend to reassert themselves. The promise of psychedelic-assisted therapy is that a small number of intensive sessions, sometimes just one or two, could produce lasting change.
Let's talk about Ibogaine, because Daniel mentioned it specifically, and it's been in the news.
Ibogaine is fascinating and terrifying in equal measure. It's derived from the root bark of the Tabernanthe iboga shrub, native to West Africa, and it's been used for centuries in Bwiti spiritual ceremonies. Pharmacologically, it's a messy drug. It hits multiple receptor systems, including the NMDA receptor, the kappa opioid receptor, and the serotonin transporter. It's also metabolized into noribogaine, which has its own pharmacological profile.
It's being studied for addiction.
Primarily opioid addiction, yes. A 2024 Phase 2 trial from the University of Sao Paulo found that a single dose of ibogaine reduced opioid cravings for up to 6 months. That's remarkable. No existing treatment comes close to that durability from a single administration. But, and this is a very large but, ibogaine has a significant cardiac toxicity risk. It prolongs the QT interval, which is a measure of the heart's electrical cycle, and prolonged QT can lead to a potentially fatal arrhythmia called torsades de pointes.
You might cure your addiction and then die of a heart problem.
That's the trade-off, and it's why ibogaine is not going to be an FDA-approved treatment in its current form. Several deaths have been associated with ibogaine use, particularly in unregulated settings. The research is now focused on synthetic ibogaine analogs, compounds that retain the anti-addictive properties, particularly the NMDA antagonism and the effects on neuroplasticity, but without the cardiac risk. There's a company called Delix Therapeutics working on this, and a few academic labs are developing non-hallucinogenic ibogaine derivatives.
Non-hallucinogenic derivatives raise an interesting question. Is the hallucinogenic experience itself necessary for the therapeutic effect?
That is one of the most debated questions in the field right now. The mystical experience, the sense of ego dissolution, of unity, of profound meaning, correlates with therapeutic outcomes in multiple studies. Patients who have stronger mystical-type experiences during their psilocybin sessions tend to show greater and more durable improvements. But correlation isn't causation, and there's active debate about whether you can separate the therapeutic neuroplasticity from the subjective trip.
If you could get the dendritic growth without the visions, would that be better medicine or worse medicine?
Better from a scalability and safety standpoint. You could administer it in a standard clinical setting without the need for two therapists sitting with the patient for 8 hours. But potentially worse if the subjective experience is actually part of the mechanism. Some researchers argue that the psychological insight, the reframing of one's life narrative that often happens during a psychedelic experience, is inseparable from the therapeutic outcome. The drug opens the window, but the meaning-making that happens inside the window is what does the healing.
Which brings us to ayahuasca and the shamanic context Daniel mentioned.
Ayahuasca is a brew made from two Amazonian plants, the Banisteriopsis copy vine and the Psychotria viridis leaf. The leaf contains DMT, which is a potent psychedelic, but DMT is broken down in the gut by monoamine oxidase. The vine contains MAO inhibitors, which prevent that breakdown and allow the DMT to reach the brain. So it's a two-component system that indigenous Amazonian cultures figured out thousands of years ago.
How they figured out which two plants to combine out of thousands of species in the rainforest is its own mystery.
It's remarkable. Pharmacologically, DMT is a serotonin 2A agonist like psilocybin, so the mechanism is similar. Increased neuroplasticity, decreased default mode network activity, the usual psychedelic signature. But ayahuasca also contains those MAO inhibitors, which have antidepressant properties of their own, and the experience is typically longer and more physically intense than psilocybin.
The clinical evidence.
The Beckley Foundation published a 2025 observational study tracking 40 participants in shaman-led ayahuasca ceremonies. They found significant reductions in PTSD symptoms at the one-month follow-up. But, and this is the same methodological problem we saw with MDMA, only more so, the setting was completely uncontrolled. These were ceremonies in the Amazon, with shamans, with group singing, with ritual purging. You can't separate the drug effect from the ritual context. Maybe the healing comes from the DMT. Maybe it comes from the community, the singing, the sense of being held in a sacred container. Probably it's both.
That's the set and setting problem you mentioned earlier.
Set is your mindset going in, your expectations, your emotional state, your intention. Setting is the environment, the room, the music, the people present, the cultural framing. In clinical trials, both are carefully controlled. Preparation sessions before the dosing day, carefully curated music playlists, 2 trained therapists present throughout, integration sessions afterward to help the patient make sense of the experience. The drug is maybe a third of the intervention.
The idea that you just take a pill and get better is wrong.
And that's one of the biggest misconceptions in the public discourse about psychedelics. The drug is a catalyst. It opens the window. But what happens inside that window depends enormously on the therapeutic container. This is why at-home self-administration is so risky, not just legally, but therapeutically. You can open up a traumatic memory without the support to process it safely, and you can end up worse than you started.
That's a sobering thought.
I walked into that one.
Let's talk about another misconception you mentioned, that all these compounds work the same way.
They really don't. Psilocybin and DMT are primarily serotonin, 2A agonists. MDMA is primarily a monoamine releaser with strong oxytocin effects. Ibogaine hits NMDA receptors, kappa opioid receptors, and serotonin transporters. It's pharmacologically promiscuous. Ketamine, which we haven't even mentioned, but which is already FDA approved for treatment-resistant depression, works primarily through NMDA antagonism and has rapid antidepressant effects, but a different durability profile. And then there's LSD, which is a serotonin 2A agonist like psilocybin, but has additional activity at dopamine receptors and lasts much longer, 8 to 12 hours versus 4 to 6 for psilocybin.
Different keys, different locks, different doors,
and different risk profiles. MDMA is relatively safe in controlled settings, but can cause hyperthermia and hyponatremia in recreational contexts. Ibogaine has the cardiac risk. Ayahuasca interacts dangerously with SSRIs and certain foods because of the MAO inhibitor component. Psilocybin has a favorable safety profile in controlled settings, but can trigger psychotic episodes in people with predispositions.
Where does the research go from here? The FDA rejection of MDMA was a setback, but you said the field has been redirected rather than stopped.
First, psilocybin is now the leading candidate for FDA approval in the psychedelic space. Compass Pathways has completed Phase 2b trials for psilocybin in treatment-resistant depression, and they're moving into Phase 3. The FDA has granted psilocybin breakthrough therapy designation for both depression and PTSD, which accelerates the review process. Non-hallucinogenic analogs. This is sometimes called psychoplastogen research, compounds that promote neuroplasticity without causing the subjective psychedelic experience. The idea is to get the dendritic growth, the BDNF increase, the reopened critical periods, without the 8-hour trip. If this works, it dramatically changes the scalability question.
Because you don't need 2 therapists per patient for a full day.
The current model for psychedelic-assisted therapy is incredibly resource-intensive. Preparation sessions, an 8-hour dosing session with 2 therapists, multiple integration sessions. The estimated cost for treatment course is between $5,000 and $15,000. That's boutique medicine. If you can put the neuroplasticity in a pill that a patient takes at home and then sees a therapist once a week, you've got something that could actually reach the millions of people who need it. Digital therapeutics plus low-dose psychedelics. There are startups exploring whether you can combine microdosing protocols with app-based cognitive behavioral therapy. The drug provides a mild plasticity boost, the app provides the structured therapeutic content, and the combination might be more than the sum of its parts. It's early stage, but it addresses the access problem directly. Expanded access and right to try. Several states, Oregon and Colorado, have led on this, have created legal frameworks for psilocybin services outside the FDA approval process. Oregon's program is already operational. It's not medical treatment in the FDA sense, it's licensed facilitation, but it's creating a real-world dataset that will inform the clinical research.
We're watching a field that's simultaneously going through the most rigorous regulatory process in the world, and also developing outside it.
That tension defines the moment. And it's why Daniel's question is so well-timed. The science is advancing rapidly, but the public understanding lags behind. People hear psychedelics for PTSD and imagine something between a Grateful Dead concert and a shamanic ritual. The reality is much more interesting. It's neurobiology, it's clinical trial design, it's public health economics.
Let's pull out some practical takeaways for someone listening who's curious about this, but not about to enroll in a clinical trial.
First, the term Daniel was looking for, memory reconsolidation under pharmacological facilitation. That's the name of the phenomenon. But the broader insight is that memory reconsolidation isn't just a drug thing. The same principles apply to any trauma work. The reconsolidation window opens whenever a memory is retrieved. You don't need psilocybin to take advantage of that. You need safety, emotional regulation, and time for integration. Those are the active ingredients that the drugs amplify, but they're available in non-drug contexts, too.
The set and setting findings have implications beyond psychedelics.
If you're doing trauma therapy of any kind, EMDR, prolonged exposure, cognitive processing therapy, the environment matters. Feeling safe matters. Having time to integrate after a session matters. The psychedelic research has basically validated what good therapists have always known, but it's given us a neurobiological framework for understanding why it works. For anyone following the clinical pipeline, psilocybin-assisted therapy is the closest to market. It has breakthrough therapy designation, it's in phase 3 trials, and it doesn't have the FDA rejection that MDMA is now working to overcome. If you want to track a specific timeline, watch Compass Pathways and the psilocybin depression trials. The misconception correction. If you take nothing else from this episode, take this. These drugs are not the treatment. They are catalysts that make the treatment possible. The therapy, the preparation, the support during the experience, the integration afterward is not optional. It is the intervention. The drug just opens the door.
That's a useful frame. It also explains why the self-administered psychonaut approach is so hit or miss. You might get lucky and have a transformative experience, or you might open something you can't close.
And the clinical trials are essentially trying to turn that hit-or-miss variability into a reliable, replicable medical procedure. That's what the FDA is evaluating, not whether psychedelics can heal people, but whether a specific protocol with a specific compound in a specific setting produces benefits that reliably outweigh the risks.
Which brings us to the question I suspect will define the next decade in this field. Even if the FDA approves psilocybin or MDMA-assisted therapy, who gets access? $5,000 to $15,000 per treatment course is not something Medicaid is going to cover enthusiastically.
That's the equity question, and it's uncomfortable. The veterans who participated in the MAPS trials, many of them had been failed by the VA system for years. They found relief in a treatment that now looks like it might be available only to people who can pay out of pocket. There are efforts to address this. Some companies are exploring value-based pricing models where insurers pay based on outcomes, and the Oregon model is designed to be more accessible than the clinical trial model. But right now, the honest answer is that we don't know if these treatments will be available to everyone who needs them or only to the wealthy.
The synthetic analogs, the non-hallucinogenic psychoplastogens, could change that equation entirely.
If you can get the neuroplasticity without the 8-hour trip and the 2-therapist requirement, the cost drops dramatically, but that research is 5 to 10 years behind the classic psychedelics. So we're looking at a near future where the first approved treatments are expensive and resource-intensive, and a longer-term future where the science might deliver something more scalable.
That's a good place to land. The science is real. The mechanisms are becoming clearer. The clinical evidence is substantial, but methodologically complicated, and the access question is wide open.
The name Daniel was looking for, memory reconsolidation under pharmacological facilitation, is going to be a term we hear more and more as this field matures.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The only surviving written account of the 1962 Pan-African Buzkashi exhibition in Sao Tome and Principe is a single typewritten page found folded inside a library copy of a Portuguese agricultural manual. It notes that the championship goat carcass was stuffed with coconut fiber instead of sand, a substitution the author describes as a concession to the humid climate that no one requested.
A concession to the humid climate that no one requested.
I have so many questions, and I suspect the answers would only raise more questions.
That's usually how it goes with Hilbert. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to us.
brush all my weird prompts where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.